This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement.
Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
Due to the graphic nature of this investigation and trial, listener discretion is advised. This episode includes discussions of child death and infanticide that some people may find offensive. We advise extreme caution for listeners under 13. It was a humid night in Greensburg, Indiana, in the summer of 1995. The buzz of cicadas rang out from a grove of trees surrounding the Crestwood Mobile Home Resort. Their humming leaked into the warm night air through the open window of a vinyl-sided trailer home. Inside, 21-year-old Christine Bunch lay beside her 3-year-old son, Anthony, or Tony. While Tony watched TV, Christine watched the little boy's eyes. He started drifting off to sleep. Soon, she picked him up and put him to bed in another room. Exhausted from a full day of single parenting her toddler and working at a nearby factory, Christine settled back onto the couch to decompress. Within minutes, she had fallen asleep herself. In the early morning hours of July 1st, 1995, Christine woke up to flames. Plumes of smoke filled the trailer in a noxious haze. Christine coughed, choking on the thick air. Then she heard him, Tony. Tony screamed from the far end of the trailer, barely audible over the flames. Christine sprinted through the thick smoke to Tony's room, but a wall of fire blocked the room's doorway. Her baby was trapped inside. How should we determine a person's guilt? Do we defer to the evidence discovered by police or the verdict reached by a jury? And what happens when the evidence and the verdict don't line up? Hi, I'm Vanessa Richardson, and this is Not Guilty, a Parcast original. Each week, we look at complicated criminal cases that test the limits of innocent until proven guilty. This week, we're examining the 1995 house fire that destroyed Christine Bunch's trailer home and killed her 3-year-old son. We'll follow the police as they conduct their arson examination and arrest a suspect for Tony's murder. Next week, we'll see how the heavy media coverage affected the case and discuss a series of appeals and retrials that present new and old evidence to the jury, ultimately leading them to their final verdict. At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. And if you enjoyed today's episode, the best way to help us is to leave a 5-star review wherever you're listening. It really does help us. We also now have merchandise. Head to parcast.com/merch for more information. Twenty-one-year-old Christine Bunch awoke to choking smoke and flames on the morning of July 1st, 1995. And though her nightmare was just beginning, she had already seen plenty of hardship. She was born in 1975 to poor, young parents. In 1985, when Christine was 10, her mother filed for divorce. She subsequently married and divorced three different men throughout Christine's childhood. Again and again, stepfathers paraded in and out of the trailer Christine shared with her mother and younger brother. Then, in 1993, 18-year-old Christine became a single mother. Tony's father, a man named Ronnie Snyder, disappeared when Christine was just 5 months pregnant. He never paid bills or contributed to any expenses related to the pregnancy. Once Tony was born, Ronnie cut off all contact with Christine, afraid that the government would track him down for child support. But Christine moved on without Ronnie's help. She and Tony moved into her mother's old trailer at the Crestwood Mobile Home Resort so that she would have help with bills and childcare. Together, the two women and little Tony managed to live a life just above the poverty line. Christine found a temp job at the local factory, working toward a machinist certification, all the while going to school at a state-funded program and single-parenting her busy toddler. Then, in the spring of 1995, not long before the fire, Christine met someone and began a new relationship. But Christine was always exhausted and often found herself feeling incredibly alone. Despite the help from her mother and her new boyfriend, she felt as if the weight of the world rested on her shoulders. At 21, her future looked so different than what she had imagined. On July 1, 1995, that future went up in smoke before her very eyes when she woke up in a house of flames. When Christine tried to rescue Tony, a wall of fire blocked her way. Through the flames, she saw Tony crying in his crib. Her mind raced faster than her body could catch up, and for a moment, Christine stood frozen in front of the blaze. She tried to suppress her panic and think quickly. She threw a nearby blanket onto the fire, hoping to smother it, but the blanket disintegrated. Immediately, Christine sprinted to the living room, gathering pillows, more blankets, anything large enough to try and stifle the flames. But as soon as she ran back to Tony's room, she saw the fire in the doorway had spread and the flames were even larger. She couldn't get in. Panicked, Christine ran outside, screaming for help, but no one was there. She rushed to the back of the house to Tony's bedroom window. She tried to break the glass with Tony's tricycle, using it as a battering ram, hitting the window again and again. By this time, the entire trailer was ablaze. Flames shot out of the roof and lit the surrounding trees. Christine eventually felt a pair of arms around her, pulling her back from the window. She looked around, realizing crowds of people had gathered in front of the burning trailer. She struggled against the arms holding her, demanding to go back for Tony. He was in the fire, but the arms would not let her go. They told her it was too late. No one inside could be saved now. She stopped struggling and stood still in the stranger's arms for a moment. As the meaning of their words sank in, Christine sank to her knees. Kneeling in the ash-covered grass, she watched the inferno, frozen in shock. By the time the fire department arrived, the trailer's thin walls had collapsed, leaving behind only a crumbling frame. The neighbor who pulled Christine away from the blaze ushered her into an ambulance. Christine was admitted to the emergency room around 7 a.m. Her hair and body were covered in soot, and her eyebrows and eyelashes were singed. She hacked from the smoke in her lungs, but miraculously, she suffered only minor burns. When her family arrived, they told her what she already knew to be true. Tony was lost to the fire. Christine stared at them, empty. He was gone. Her baby was gone. By 8 a.m. on July 1st, the fire had been completely extinguished. All that remained of Christine's trailer was a charred skeleton of iron rods and beams, and what was left was immediately picked over by authorities. Their efforts were led by Brian Frank and James Skaggs, field investigators for the Indiana Fire Marshal. For the next 2 hours, they carefully examined the wreckage, trying to determine what caused the fire. All fires start somewhere. Field investigators generally assess several key elements of a burn site to determine where a blaze originated. But when a building has almost entirely burned to the ground, these elements are all the more difficult to find. One of the most dependable methods of identifying a fire's source is by looking for patterns of burn marks. In 1995, fire science relied heavily on the use of V-shaped burn patterns to determine the location of a fire's origin. Investigators would typically start with the V markings outside of a fire's burn path, then follow the pattern's outer lines back to the source. Essentially, V marked the spot. But as they examined the scene, Frank discovered two prominent V-shaped burn patterns on the floor, one in the living room and one in Tony's bedroom. Two Vs indicated that the fire originated in two separate areas of the trailer. This was very unusual for an accidental fire, and it made the investigators suspicious of Christine's account of events. According to arson investigator John Lentini's book, Scientific Protocols for Fire Investigation, the discovery of multiple points of origin has traditionally been regarded as slam dunk evidence of arson. In an accidental house fire, the beginning of a blaze almost always originates in one location. Starting in two places would be nearly impossible, at least without human assistance. As fire science has developed over time, multiple burn patterns can now be explained by a phenomenon called flashover. This occurs when a single fire creates a steady layer of hot, dense smoke that forms at the ceiling. As the smoke climbs in temperature, the blazing hot gas begins to descend. These hot gases can suddenly ignite, and within minutes, a single fire in a room can turn into a room on fire, leaving behind multiple V-shaped burn patterns. However, in 1995, the concept of flashover was not well understood and wasn't applied to Christine's investigation. In addition, investigators Frank and Skaggs discovered other clues at the scene that made them doubt that the fire was an accident. Just 3 feet from the trailer's front door, they discovered an empty gas can. With a liquid accelerant found on the scene, the investigators looked more closely at the burn patterns. Then they noticed something peculiar. The V burn lines directed them to distinct holes in the trailer floor. Because fire burns upward and outward, not down, Frank and Skaggs concluded that something had to have drawn the fire into the floor to create these kinds of holes. Something like gasoline. Their suspicions were soon bolstered by a hydrocarbon detector, a tool used to detect traces of combustible fuels. Then, to ensure the detector's accuracy, a trained arson dog was brought in to sniff the burn patterns. Immediately, the dog confirmed the presence of fuel. This wasn't an accident. It was arson. Coming up, authorities question Christine about the night of the blaze, trying to determine the truth. Now, back to the story. On July 1st, 1995, 21-year-old Christine Bunch's trailer home burned to the ground. In addition to losing her residence, her 3-year-old son, Tony, was killed by the fire. Christine told police that the fire was an accident. She woke up to flames everywhere. But when fire investigators Brian Frank and James Skaggs inspected the scene, they became suspicious that it was set intentionally. In only a few short hours, Frank and Skaggs had not only found signs of arson, but potentially the accelerant that had been used. Evidence was rapidly appearing, and they needed to move just as fast to follow its lead. Police recovered Christine's nightgown from the hospital. They were surprised that, though it appeared to have been exposed to smoke, the gown had managed to escape the blaze without a single burn. If Christine had attempted to rescue Tony in the face of the wall of flames that she described, wouldn't the nightgown have been singed? In addition, investigators collected samples from the trailer, including flooring, tack strips, and paneling. They were sent to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, or the ATF, to be tested. The samples would be analyzed by forensic scientists through gas chromatography to determine the exact type of liquid accelerant used in the crime. They hoped the results would confirm their suspicions about the gasoline can they found. In the meantime, investigators Frank and Skaggs believed they had come to an almost bulletproof conclusion. The fire had been deliberately set by pouring a liquid accelerant directly onto the trailer's floor in two separate places, in the living room and in Tony's bedroom. They had an arson case on their hands. But who struck the match? While the investigation continued, Christine was assessed and treated for injuries at the hospital. Dr. Michael Arnett noted that while she did have some burns, there were fewer than he would have assumed given the size of the fire. The hair around her forehead had been singed, and she had a small blister on the tip of her nose, an injury consistent with brief, direct exposure to fire. Her arms were mostly unaffected, red, but no worse than a sunburn. Her saliva contained soot. The doctor also checked Christine's lungs, but at the time she smoked cigarettes, so it was hard to determine if she showed signs of smoke inhalation or if it was simply damage caused by smoking. All in all, it seemed that somehow Christine had managed to escape the inferno almost unscathed. As she was being treated, Christine grew more and more distraught and panicked as the shock of the morning wore off and was replaced by the reality of all that she'd lost. Dr. Arnett decided to give her a dose of Xanax and wrote her a prescription to take home, advising her to use it to help her sleep. Not long after her assessment with Dr. Arnett, a team from the sheriff's office arrived at the hospital to speak with Christine. Having heard investigator Frank and Skaggs' suspicions about the origin of the fire, they wanted to clarify Christine's account of events. They asked her family to leave the small hospital room so they could speak with her alone. When Indiana State Police Trooper Peter Tressler sat down with Christine, he observed that she seemed distant and disconnected from the conversation, a far cry from the grieving mother he had pictured. However, he was unaware that Dr. Arnett had given Christine a dose of Xanax, which promotes calmness. In addition to the medication, grief reactions can vary from person to person. Psychotherapist and author Amy Lowe described this same kind of emotional disconnect in her book, Emotional Intensity and Sensitivity. Lowe explained that when faced with extreme situations, individuals may feel a sort of freezing of emotions and detachment from the world around them, as if nothing is really real. The mind defensively disconnects as a way to survive an otherwise overwhelming trauma. But to Tressler, Christine's distant affect was interpreted as something else entirely: cold indifference. He asked Christine to recount the time leading up to the fire. She explained that she and Tony had fallen asleep on the couch in the living room the night before. She woke up to Tony calling out to her. When she went to his bedroom, she saw flames in the doorway, but she couldn't see Tony because of the smoke. She returned to the living room to get a blanket to throw over the flames, but the blanket caught fire, and so Christine began to beat the flames with a pillow. The fire just got worse, and soon the flames were too high for her to get into the bedroom to look for Tony. After writing down her account, Tressler asked Christine to go over the events again. This time, Christine said that when she woke up, she didn't see any smoke, and the flames weren't in the bedroom doorway, but in front of one of the bedroom windows. She told Tressler that she saw Tony on the opposite side of the room. Tressler couldn't believe what he was hearing. Just minutes ago, Christine told him an almost entirely different series of events. Something wasn't right. He asked Christine to go over that morning one more time. Exhausted, Christine stumbled through her statement for the third time. Her memory of the event was like a fog, and she couldn't see clearly to the other side. She told Tressler that she saw no smoke when she woke up, but this time, when she went to Tony's bedroom, there were flames on the floor beside the bed. She left the room to find the fire extinguisher, but by the time she came back, the flames were already out the bedroom door, and there was nothing she could do. With three inconsistent statements, Tressler was no longer convinced that Christine was telling the truth. Why was she changing her story? What was she hiding? As Tressler wrapped up the interview, Christine's aloof demeanor suddenly changed. With great concern, she asked if they found Tony. He tried to deflect the question, but Christine was consumed. She had to know where he was. She had to know that her baby hadn't just been lost inside the trailer. But to Tressler, this question wasn't that of a grieving mother, but of a concerned perp. Was she preoccupied because she didn't want Tony's body discovered? Tressler chose his words carefully. Yes, Tony had been found. Firefighters had retrieved him from the trailer, and his body was being examined by a forensics team for evidence. He paused. They suspected Tony had been murdered. Christine wanted to scream, but she could hardly breathe. She was paralyzed. The policeman's words permeated her chest and rang through her entire body. Murdered. Tony had been murdered. While Christine fumbled through her interview with Tressler, investigators at the scene were uncovering even more suspicious details in Tony Bunch's death. When they spoke with the firefighter who had recovered Tony's body, he told them that his path to the far bedroom had been obstructed. When he entered the blazing trailer, he struggled to get around a large object in the hallway. Ultimately, he was forced to crawl over it entirely. After the fire was put out, investigators identified the object as a reclining chair. It partially obstructed the doorway to the bedroom. But how did a piece of furniture find its way almost directly in front of the bedroom entrance? Was it deliberately placed there to block firefighters from entering the room? When the firefighter searched through debris, he found what appeared to be a small, stiff doll between the bed and the wall. But soon he realized that he had found the body of a small boy. It was Tony. Tony's body was transported to Indiana University Medical Center in Indianapolis, where an autopsy was performed. The forensic pathologist reported that Tony's body had been completely charred and that soot was found inside his mouth, nose, and even his trachea. The forensic report determined that the three-year-old died from smoke inhalation. By the time Tressler reported back with the inconsistent testimonies that afternoon, investigators had only become more convinced of their suspicions. The case had reeked of foul play from the beginning, and the supporting evidence was piling up around them. Eventually, they landed on just one suspect, Christine Bunch. She was the sole survivor of the fire and the only person home that night, other than her toddler son. All signs at the scene led to the conclusion that the fire was set intentionally using a liquid accelerant. In addition, Christine kept changing her story. She gave three different versions back to back within an hour. She had something to hide. And then there was her detached, aloof behavior when questioned. Investigators knew what grief looked like, and Christine Bunch wasn't showing it. It also didn't appear that anyone else had a motive to set the fire. Tony's absent father, Ronnie, didn't have any kind of criminal background, and he had been successfully evading any child support payments. Setting the fire would only reveal himself to authorities. There were no angry neighbors or jilted lovers. Christine's sole enemy was perhaps only herself. As a young single mother struggling to keep her head above water, authorities explored the possibility that Christine burned down the trailer in an attempt to collect insurance money or government aid. Perhaps Tony's death was just an unintended side effect, the result of poor planning and desperate measures. But investigators didn't find any property insurance policies in Christine's name. Next, they revisited the idea that perhaps Christine did intend to kill Tony, and she had taken a policy out on his life that she planned to collect on. But once again, their search came up fruitless. Further searching revealed that Christine and Tony were on food stamps. They barely had money for groceries, much less a monthly life insurance payment. But as investigators overturned more stones of Christine's life, they revealed more and more details of the 21-year-old single mother's situation. With no partner support, no money, and little education, the world seemed stacked against Christine Bunch, and perhaps her son was just too heavy of a burden for her to carry any longer. Maybe in her desperation, a fire seemed like the only way out. Investigators began to consider this as the most likely motive. Both Frank and Skaggs concluded that Christine had poured an accelerant, such as gasoline or kerosene, onto the linoleum floor of both rooms before lighting a match. Once the fire had started, Christine had simply let Tony die. Reinvigorated, Frank and Skaggs pressed forward with the investigation. If they could get it, they wanted more hard evidence before they cornered Christine. First, they tested the gas can they had found at the trailer's front door for fingerprints. They recovered several partial prints, but none of them matched Christine's. Then they checked all the gas stations in the area and conducted interviews with each attendant to see if anyone recognized Christine Bunch or had seen her at their station buying gas or kerosene. No one had. Despite this, Frank and Skaggs stood their ground. They felt they had evidence beyond a doubt that the fire was arson. They even had proof of how it was done. They just needed their suspect to confess. Tressler called Christine at her mother's house, where she'd gone after being released from the hospital, and asked her to come to the police station immediately. When she arrived at the station around 10 p.m., Christine was still groggy. She'd taken another Xanax a few hours previously to help her sleep, not expecting to have to go anywhere else that night. She stepped into the station in bare feet. All of her shoes had been lost to the fire. Christine was ushered into a small interrogation room while her mother waited outside. As she took stock of her surroundings, she began to realize why they had asked her to come in so urgently. The police didn't believe her. Coming up, Christine sits for her fourth police interview, once again changing the details of her story. Now back to the story. 16 hours after losing her home and her 3-year-old son, 21-year-old Christine Bunch sat down for her fourth conversation with police. As they began to probe her statement, Christine realized that the officers didn't think she was telling the truth about what happened. She was shocked, exhausted, and most importantly, unaware of her rights. Christine didn't know she was entitled to consult an attorney before giving any statements, and she had no time to find out. She had been released from the hospital a mere 8 hours earlier. Christine walked police through her account of the fire, and yet again, she careened into a different story. She told investigators that she and Tony had fallen asleep together in his bedroom, not the living room, and that she had woken up to Tony laughing. She then saw that the linoleum floor was burning, and she left the room to get a blanket to smother the flames. The blanket quickly melted, so she left the room a second time to retrieve a pillow to beat the fire. Like in her third testimony, but not the first two, Christine claimed the fire started to grow, so she ran to find the fire extinguisher. When she came back, the flames had grown too tall for her to get to Tony. Christine spoke in the same manner that she had to Tressler earlier that day. She was cold, seemingly devoid of emotion, and most importantly, inconsistent. But again, police were unaware that she had recently taken a Xanax, which would have blunted her emotions and made her groggy. After several hours of interrogation, but no confession, the police agreed to release Christine if she returned to take a polygraph test. At that point, Christine felt completely depleted by the day's events. She didn't know what a polygraph test was, but she was desperate to go home. She agreed. 3 days later, on July 5, 1995, Christine returned to the station. She was hooked up to the polygraph machine and strapped in a chair facing a wall, away from the polygraph operator. With her back to the polygraph, Christine felt as though the operator was trying to make her feel as though he was sneaking up on her. For perhaps the first time since being questioned, Christine felt genuine anxiety, but she also was tired. The Xanax she had been prescribed and was taking regularly made her drowsy. Staying alert to her surroundings was difficult. A polygraph machine, or lie detector test, is used by police to determine a person's veracity during a line of questioning. By monitoring psychophysiological changes like heart rate, blood pressure, and respiration, investigators believed they could reliably detect fear and anxiety in an interviewee and thus know when they were lying. However, in more recent years, the accuracy of polygraph testing is controversial, if not entirely unfounded. Its underlying flaw is crucial. An honest person can be just as anxious as a deceptive one. As he conducted the test with Christine, the operator changed the tone of his voice at each question. He asked her why she didn't grab Tony while she was in the bedroom. Christine claimed that her nightgown had caught fire. But the police knew that wasn't true, even without the polygraph. The nightgown they had collected from the hospital was full of soot, but not burned. Next, the operator showed Christine a diagram of the fire scene, indicating where the reclining chair had been placed in the bedroom doorway. Christine denied any knowledge of the chair moving, claiming that the chair should not have been near the doorway at all. The operator continued as the polygraph whirred away, slipping in perhaps the most critical question of the case. He asked, "Why did you start the fire?" Christine allegedly responded, "I don't know." With that indirect admission of guilt, the operator ended the questioning. He turned Christine around to face him and informed her that she had failed the polygraph test. Then he paused. Looking at her closely, he told Christine that he knew that she had killed her son. Christine looked right back at him. She was beaten down and exhausted, and the last scrap of hope she had been clutching to was being wrestled from her grasp. But she tightened her grip, and she told him she wanted a lawyer. After the polygraph test, Christine was immediately arrested. By this time, a probable cause affidavit had been formally issued by Indiana State Fire investigators, explaining an accelerant was used in the trailer fire. On July 5th, Christine was formally charged with arson and the murder of Tony Bunch. She was taken to jail that night. The next morning, she was finally able to speak with a lawyer, 46-year-old public defender Frank Hamilton Jr. Hamilton had never defended anything more serious than petty crimes. Now he found himself sitting across from a handcuffed 21-year-old woman charged not just with arson, but with the murder of her child. Christine, lacking any education of the law or court system, took all of her cues from Hamilton. Before anything else, he firmly advised Christine not to speak to anyone regarding the case, especially the media. And she didn't. For more than 2 months while she was in jail in Decatur County, Christine spoke to no one except her immediate family. But while Christine anxiously awaited her trial date, she was already being tried in the court of public opinion. Local media quickly learned of the scandalous accusations, and the news spread across Indiana faster than the fire that consumed her trailer home. For months while she languished in jail, articles speculated as to why Christine would have killed her 3-year-old son, and what kind of mother would remain silent in the wake of her child's death. Indiana newspaper articles painted Christine as a leech on the system, claiming that the young single mother was not only on food stamps, but also unemployed and suffering emotionally from her poor life decisions. And because Christine had been instructed to avoid the media, she said nothing to contradict the claims. But while the media poisoned her name, Christine finally received a small reprieve, citing a lack of evidence and no tendency to run, no motive, and no insurance money. Christine was let out on bail on October 12, 1995, according to Letters from Prison, Voice of Women Murderers. She could wait for her February trial at home with her family. As she walked out of the building, a reporter snapped her picture. The media quickly circulated the photo, asking why someone who murdered their own child was let out of jail. The police started tailing her if they saw her outside her house. Even regular people in Greensburg would whisper and point. Some would even call out to her, yelling, "Baby killer," for all to hear. The unwanted attention drove Christine from the public eye. She avoided leaving the house as much as she could, spending much of her time feeling as though she had been consumed by an endless black hole. But while on parole, Christine found support not only from her family, but in the budding relationship she had left behind when she was jailed. She reconnected with the boyfriend she had been seeing at the time of the fire and found herself spending a lot of time with him. When they were together, Christine felt safe from the nightmare of her looming trial. With him, she still felt that maybe somehow it would all be okay. Then, within weeks of being released, Christine became pregnant. It wasn't planned. In fact, she had used a prophylactic. The possibility of bringing another life into the world after Tony's death frightened her. But at the same time, it felt like a lifeline, a connection to a new hope she hadn't had before. But when she told her boyfriend about the pregnancy, he dealt Christine yet another blow. He confessed that he was married and had no plans to leave his wife. Christine was shocked and hurt, but ultimately decided to keep the baby despite this news and despite her pending trial. Her mother agreed to take care of the baby if Christine was convicted. In the months leading up to her court date, the debate over Christine Bunch's guilt or innocence continued to play out in multiple publications. Newspapers printed stories claiming that Christine had killed Tony because she was sick of being a mother. Others speculated she had become psychologically impaired from the isolation and abandonment of being a single mom, resulting in a belief that Tony was literally better off dead than living in their dire situation. Articles described her behavior as cold and unfeeling. The morning of the fire, they claimed Christine had stood alongside other bystanders and simply watched as the growing inferno killed her young son. Then the local newspaper, the Greensburg Daily News, dropped a bombshell. They ran an article stating that Christine had been given a polygraph and failed. In addition, they claimed that she confessed to setting the fire. The evidence, they said, was damning. Worst of all, the article was published on February 25, 1996, the day before Christine Bunch's trial began, and every potential juror in Greensburg had seen the headline. Thanks for listening to Not Guilty. We'll be back Thursday with our next episode on Christine Bunch. First, we'll cover her initial trial and then follow her dogged pursuit of an advocate who would help her bring old and new evidence before the courts. We'll also explore the evolving world of fire science and the developments that would emerge to affect the case's incriminating evidence. You can find more episodes of Not Guilty, as well as all of Parcast's other shows, on Spotify or your favorite podcast directory. Several of you have asked how to help us. If you enjoy the show, the best way to help is to leave a 5-star review. And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network. In the meantime, based on the evidence presented, decide for yourself. Was Christine Bunch a grieving mother whose young son's life was lost to a freak house fire? Or was she a murderer? Find out next week. Not Guilty was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Carrie Murphy, with production assistance by Paul Mahler, additional production assistance by Maggie Admire and Freddie Beckley. This episode of Not Guilty was written by Alex Garland. I'm Vanessa Richardson.